when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Squanderlust, the podcast about the emotional side of money, why our actions aren't always as good as our intentions, and what we can do about it. I'm your host, Martha Lawton. Today's episode may be a challenging one for some listeners, so I'm getting the warning in early. We're going to be talking about addiction, specifically gambling addiction. And with addiction comes a lot of pain. So we will, amongst other things, be talking about suicide. And if that's a topic you don't want to hear about, or if you're listening around children and feel this is inappropriate for them to hear, please do just skip this one. That said, I think this story is pretty inspiring. I think you will too. So I'm really excited to get on and do this one. Today, we welcome Chris Murphy, darts commentator and communications manager and gambling education facilitator for the charity Sporting Chance. Chris, welcome.
Hi, Martha. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm really delighted. I think you have an important story to tell, especially at the moment where in lockdown, I know that gambling has become more of an issue. There have been more people with a lot of time on their hands who've ended up perhaps gambling where they wouldn't have previously. So I think this is topical.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So can you give our listeners a bit more of an introduction to yourself, please?
Yeah, so as you said, now I'm a darts commentator and work for the Sporting Chance charity, among a few other little things that I do. Mm-hmm. But in terms of gambling, I started gambling when I was 17. The very short story is that I won my first bet, although I'm sure we'll delve into a little bit more that it might not be as simple as it seems. but I won my first bet, which came in at 175-1 as a 17-year-old. And became addicted almost instantly. I was at college at the time. I ended up getting thrown out of college because I didn't go to the lessons, because I just went to the pubs and the bookies and gambled. And it resulted in a suicide attempt for me when I was 23 years old, after gambling probably every day for 6 years. And then after that, my sort of road to recovery has been quite a long, bumpy one, which has included a lot of relapses. But as we sit talking today, I'm more than 2.5 years gambling free, and also alcohol free as well, which is part of my journey that I wasn't probably aware of until a couple of years ago. So that's a short version, but I'm sure we can dig more in depth into the places you want to go.
Yeah, congratulations on your 2.5 years of sobriety and being gambling free. That's quite the achievement. I'd like to hear a bit more about that first kind of gambling experience. I mean, it's quite something to be 17 years old and have your first bet come in at such long odds.
Yeah, absolutely. I only did it really because I was playing football, in the men's team by then. Not at any great level, just a local village team. But they all used to go into the bookies before the match, before meeting up for the match, and just put these bets on. And I'd been in there, several times, probably for a year or so, and not even considered doing it. And then one day I kind of just asked one of them, oh, what is it that you do? And he showed me how to put an accumulator bet on. And then it was actually a bit of a joke, really. I did the opposite to every team that he did.
Right.
And they turned out to win at that you know, that huge price.
Yeah.
And yeah, I come from a family that's got sort of an interesting financial background, because my nan used to work in a betting shop,
right,
and my mum was a bank manager. So sort of opposite ends of the scale. Mm. And when I won, I got really sort of strong warnings from both of them. My nan obviously having seen the damage that this kind of thing can do to people from her job. And my mum has always been a very much a saver and very sort of economical with money and very smart with money. Didn't take many risks or anything like that. So the idea of gambling for her wasn't, you know, she was a bit worried from the beginning.
Mm.
And, you know, it turned out that they were both right to be. But it just went to my head, you know, really quickly. It as you said, 17-year-old, it was all in cash. It was kind of before online gambling had really taken hold like it has today. So I went to the bookies, collected the cash. It was only a few hundred pounds, but for a 17-year-old lad, I'd never held that amount of money before. It was just the best thing in the world, you know, the best feeling in the world. And
sure,
one I wanted to recreate, and tried and tried and tried,
yeah,
for the next 6 years.
Do you think if you hadn't won that first bet, you might not have gone down that path? Or what do you think might have changed?
I think maybe if I didn't win any bet, I might not have gone down that path. It may probably would have happened at some point.
Mm.
I look back, I mean, I've done a lot of therapy and things, and I look back to my childhood, and I remember things like when the National Lottery came out, for example,
yeah,
and I used to write down like six numbers, you know, as a as a young kid, and really take my head would go to that I was involved in this National Lottery draw and spend Saturday mentally spending the winnings, you know, as what, a 12, 13-year-old boy. And I think, so I think it was always, you know, part of my DNA, really, part of my makeup, part of my personality, sort of waiting to come out.
Right.
And not necessarily in gambling, but that's kind of the thing that seemed to serve that, you know, scratch that itch,
right,
the best. But obviously it ended up being really damaging.
What happened next? I mean, you know, you won that first bet, you got hooked pretty quickly. So how did that progress for you?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to describe it, although it's not entirely accurate,
right,
but the easiest way to describe it is it became a full-time job, really.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was at college, as I said, and I was studying for my A-levels. I'd applied for university to go and do a sports journalism degree, which is what I always wanted to do. I always wanted to become a commentator, actually. And within weeks, I'd got thrown out of college. It was about 2 or 3 weeks before I was due to take the A-levels.
Oof.
And I'd not been to any lessons for about 3 or 4 weeks because I'd just got this amount of money and carried on going to pubs and bookies. So really my future was the first thing that I lost, and it was that quickly, you know, like 4 or 5 weeks from placing this first bet to ended up being thrown out of college from it. And that was one of the worst things that could have happened, because when you get thrown out of education, what do? You go and find a job.
Mm.
And what does a job give you? It gives you money.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I was, you know, getting money every week.
Yeah.
An amount of money that I never had. I would go to work. I was working in a warehouse, and I would go to work Monday to Friday, get paid on a Thursday night. And basically I would go out on the Thursday night, the Friday, the Saturday, the Sunday, and have no money by the Monday.
Right.
Just drinking and gambling, basically. And that was a pattern for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
But over the next sort of few years, as I moved into 18, I remember on my 18th birthday, I didn't have any money to go out.
Oops.
So I phoned the bank for an overdraft. And it was around the time that they were just throwing money at everybody.
Right.
Before the financial crash. I'm not saying that I'm responsible for the crash, but I probably played a small part in it. I got offered a loan, basically,
right,
an 18-year-old, I think, about £2,500.
Yes.
And I just saw it as free money, because I didn't really sort of understand, you know. Well, I understood you had to pay it back, but the addiction in me was telling me, yeah, but you'll win this, so you can just win it and pay it back, and, you know, what a master plan that will be. So I went down that path then of borrowing, and it was just a real balancing act. I just felt like some kind of Del Boy type character, just trying to balance the books with gambling all the time. But actually, what I was doing was borrowing and getting deeper and deeper into debt, and then having to borrow from places that were higher interest, and then even borrowing from loan sharks and things like that towards the end of that period. But while still balancing a fairly normal life, like I had relationships, I got better jobs and things like that.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a functioning addiction on the surface at that time until it kind of all came crashing down, because during that period I would lose those relationships, I would lose those jobs, and by the end of that sort of 6 years I was just working basically cash in hand work, like bar work and window cleaning and things like that, where I'd literally get paid at the end of the day, would ask my boss for the wage at the end of the day rather than the end of the week, and go to the bookies, and if I lost it I'd be, you know, at work an hour early hoping to get an extra hour in, and if I won I might not even turn up the next day because I had money to go gambling with.
Right. Yes. I think when you talk about that, and it's obvious in hindsight the damage that it was doing to you. And I think there are people who maybe just wouldn't really get it. So can you describe some of the kind of the feelings that were driving you? I mean, you've already said there was this self-image of like being a bit of a wheeler dealer, kind of del boy, almost like a fantasy person that you were trying to be.
Yeah, I think fantasy is actually a good way of describing it. I think that I lived in a dream world. I think everybody has dreams that maybe seem out of reach, you know, dreams of being a millionaire or whatever it might be. And I think that I've genuinely thought that I'd found a direct route to achieving that kind of dream. And I just, because I'd had big wins from time to time, I felt a reinforcement of that, and that was possible. And, you know, for most of the time, I just carried on really, like, in pursuit. I kind of got it in my head that there was some kind of law of averages that if I just carried on relentlessly going down this route, then one day I was going to have, you know, the best day that anyone's ever had gambling. And all the damage that I'd done didn't matter because I could just pay off the debt and stuff like that. Obviously not taking into account the emotional damage that I'd done, the damage in relationships, all those kind of things. I just thought that one big win would fix everything. And obviously in hindsight, it's, you know, the analogy I would use is that when you're digging a hole, the only way to get out of it is to stop digging, really. And that's really what I was doing in reality. But in my mind, the only way out of the mess that I was causing was through gambling. And it wasn't really until, you know, the few weeks before that suicide attempt that the idea of that not happening even entered my mind at all.
Yeah, it's funny because I've heard gambling, or particularly the lottery, described as being like a tax on hope. And that does seem to kind of fit in with what you're talking about. Like it was because you're a very sort of optimistic and hopeful person in some ways that you were spending that money.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a dreamer. I still am in many ways. But I think that's exactly right. I also think it is important to understand in any addiction, gambling, alcohol, other drugs, whatever it might be, what positive thing that is giving you. And so for me, hope certainly was one of them. And you know, a life without hope is a difficult life, isn't it? I also think escapism, but then when you dig down into it, you think if you're seeking escapism in something, then what are you trying to escape from? And I think one of my personality traits, I think, you know, I call it dreaming now, I think it was probably even stronger than that. It was almost magical thinking in my gambling days, and I kind of realised now that I didn't really know where I fit in the world, particularly after losing that college place and not going on to university to do what I thought I was going to do. So for those 6 years in particular, I had no direction, kind of no hope other than in gambling. And I think it was giving me an escape from a life that I didn't really feel connected to. And when I think about it like that, then I can kind of totally understand why it would be attractive to me and why I wanted to, because who wouldn't want connection, you know, escapism, hope, love almost, because it was the only place that I kind of felt I belonged. So, right. You know, who wouldn't want all those things?
Yeah, I can imagine if your relationships are falling apart and you're having difficulty in other areas of your life, then I assume there was some social aspect as well to the gambling, where you would spend time with other people who were also gambling, and yeah, there was a place to be in that.
Yeah, I mean there was, but also it was a strange one, because you would think you were doing that, because you would go out, for example, if I went to the pub, I would go out to the pub with all my friends, very social, hated being at home, didn't like where I lived, had to be, you know, out and doing something all the time. Usually that was gambling. But I'd be the one in the corner on the fruit machine, mm-hmm. For hours and hours and hours. So even though I felt like I was a very social character, actually, in a way, I was isolated in the crowd.
Right, right. Yeah, interesting. Let's talk about what caused the change. You reached a low point, so tell us about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the day that it happened, it was 2010. As I said, been gambling for 5 or 6 years, almost every day, getting into more and more debt, and I'd, you know, had work opportunities and things like that that had all sort of fallen apart. And it just started to become apparent to me. I just started to question whether this was actually going to happen, because I was just like, it had gone from, you know, always being able to get money to like sometimes literally having to go looking down the back of a sofa for 20 pence to put like a horse racing accumulator bet on that day, just so that I had a bit of action and to get the sort of blood pumping for that day and to have that little bit of hope.
Yeah.
So that started happening. I should just mention here as well that I had a couple of times sought help before, but this was in the past, it had been down to somebody else, kind of me doing it to please somebody else, or in the early stages, literally my mum taking me, driving me to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting and sitting in the car until I'd finished. So I never really did it willingly before. But this time it was, I just kind of knew that it was coming to an end, that it wasn't going to happen. And the day that I attempted to die by suicide, all my friends, ironically, had gone to the races. And I hadn't gone because by then everybody was kind of aware of my problem. So I hadn't been invited out of love, you know, totally out of love, but I'd not been invited to the races. And I sat there and I kind of, maybe that in itself made me think, what are you doing? You know, you're losing out on things because of this. The thought of stopping, you know, was too much. This thing, I'd become dependent on this thing, just like someone who becomes dependent on a substance. You know, it was, I needed it to breathe, really. And I sat down and I made a list of not all of my debts, but just the most pressing debts, the ones that I really needed to pay off, particularly the debts to people, so to friends, to loan sharks, things like that. I rightly or wrongly knew that with financial institutions, I had a little bit more leeway and could hide a bit more, I suppose. But I wrote all the list down, and then I looked at how much money I had available, which wasn't an awful lot. And I just made a decision in that moment, and I said to myself, right, I'm going to take the ultimate gamble here. I'm going to either win this amount, pay off these things, and that probably wouldn't have been a good route because it would have just allowed me to carry on gambling.
Yeah.
But the alternative was that I was going to kill myself. And I went that day with the money that I had. And usually, as I said before, usually it'd fluctuate quite a bit. I'd go up and down. But this day, I just could not hit a single winning bet on the machines, on the races, whatever it was. And the money just disappeared, I think, within less than half an hour.
Wow.
And I just almost felt like, again, with my sort of magical thinking, I've always had like a spiritual element to the way that I think. Not really in a religious way, but some sort of yearning for the to be some kind of greater power, I suppose.
Mm.
And I kind of took it as, well, this is like the higher power telling you that you should die because you've just lost straight away and that's it. You're doing the right thing by ending your life. And the thoughts that were going through my head were, and I know that a lot of people in the past there's been a stigma about suicide as being a selfish act, But having been in that situation and had those thoughts, I can honestly say that all of my thoughts were for other people and a genuine belief that their life would be better if I wasn't around anymore. And that's how I felt. My mum wouldn't have to worry anymore. My friends wouldn't have to, you know, go through the dilemma of whether or not it was right to lend me money, and all those kind of things. And yeah, I just got into that frame of mind. I knew that one of the friends I shared a house with took sleeping pills.
Right.
So I wrote a suicide note and I put it in my bedside drawer because I didn't want it to be visible. I wanted people to find it when it was too late, I right. suppose. And then I went up to his room, opened his bedside drawer, and all these sort of tablets were loose in his bed. So I just grabbed loads of them. I then went to the fridge and, for whatever reason, grabbed a beer and a cake. And right. I walked up to the moors near where I lived, and it was kind of some sort of last, you know, I'm going to enjoy this last moment and then take these pills. And I did take the pills, and nothing really happened. So I was just sort of wandering around a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the sort of crux of it is that I'd taken the wrong pills. So my friends...
I shouldn't laugh, but...
No, well, I do now, because it's, you know, one of those... maybe there is a higher being, and maybe that was what was meant to happen, because his sleeping pills were in the next drawer down, the one that hadn't opened.
Right.
And these were actually just hay fever tablets.
Oh, he
got like, yeah, and I don't know why they were all loose and not in packets and things like that. But yeah, these were hay fever tablets, so I tried to overdose on hay fever tablets. And, you know, it's a light side of a sad story. And yeah. One of the things is I get really bad hay fever now. So... It did. They don't work for preventing hay fever. But when I do go through that in the summer, it kind of serves as a little bit of a reminder, and you know, makes me grateful. Instead of sort of being a bit grumpy about sneezing and all that kind of thing, it just kind of makes me grateful to be alive. So yeah, that was what happened, and then someone did find the note,
right?
And then alerted my parents, and my parents came and found me, and they found me sort of just wandering around, waiting for these things to kick in, because obviously at that point I didn't know that they were the wrong tablets.
Yeah.
And they took me back to their place, my mum and my stepdad. I had a long conversation with my mum, and basically I was telling her what had been going on for the last 5 years. And I just remember the only question she asked, but she asked it probably 100 times,
yeah.
was, is there anything else? And yeah. there just kept being something else until it was all out. And the next day I went to a meeting at a support group and spoke to the doctor and got some CBT set up and things like that. And that was really the start of my sort of journey into trying to stop gambling and trying to sort of beat the addiction. And as I said, it hasn't always been a smooth one, but that was the real turning point, the sort of rock bottom moment, if you like.
That's well, I'm so glad that you took the wrong tablets. I'm so glad to be able to be here and talking to you today. So and I'm so glad to hear as well that your mum was able to be so supportive in that moment. We're going to take a little break here, and when we come back, we'll have a bit more of a chat about your recovery journey.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome back. We're talking to Chris Murphy, darts commentator and communications manager for the charity Sporting Chance, about recovery from gambling addiction. So you said that your recovery journey hasn't always been a smooth one. Tell us a bit about what's involved in recovering from a gambling addiction.
So initially, when I first tried to get into recovery, the only thing that was really available was Gamblers Anonymous. That's meetings like AA, a fellowship of men and women who have got the same problem and come together to try and beat it really collectively. And that's group meetings. Obviously, it's not therapy. There are no professionals involved, but it's just mutual support. And there is a kind of program of recovery that has been designed by previous members, or initially members of Alcoholics Anonymous, that designed that 12-step program. And then in terms of sort of professional support around then, I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that I've had gambling addiction on my medical record since 2010. Right. I've met a lot of people since then whose doctors wouldn't put that on their medical record.
Wow.
So I'm quite lucky in that sense. However, even though it was logged, it was go to Gamblers Anonymous to sort that out.
Right.
And we'll give you some pills for depression.
Right.
And while I have been through sort of severe bouts of depression, it's usually been linked, or certainly was then, to my addiction.
Mm.
So I kind of felt like, in terms of professional support, all that was really on offer, and I found this with CBT as well,
right,
was coping mechanisms,
right,
you know, ways to like fix a roof when the foundations were crumbling.
Mm.
And more recently, I've, the last two and a half years since I've been on this, you know, the longest run of clean time, if you like, I've ever been, I've found different ways. So I go to another support group. It's still the same 12-step program, but there are people from different addictions there. And I also I've been seeing a therapist that whole time, actually two different therapists, but I've been in therapy that whole time.
Yeah.
And doing more psychotherapy, more a look at the root causes and a little bit of, you know, getting to know myself really and getting to understand myself, rather than just learning how to deal with triggers and deal with urges and things like that. And what I've found is that in the last 2.5 years of prospering, really, of thriving, of doing that sort of deeper work, I haven't had the triggers and I haven't had the urges. So I think that before that, it was a bit of a white knuckle ride. And to be honest, I had a lot of relapses, and I think there were kind of three types of addicts, broadly speaking. I think there are the addicts that never really either don't accept that they've got an addiction, so therefore don't seek help, or just accept that that's their way of life and carry on. So the addicts that never get help.
Yeah.
I think there are addicts that try to get help but struggle and continue to relapse, but it might be enough to sort of keep them living some kind of quality of life, and then there are the addicts that recover and get on and often really thrive and prosper in life.
Yeah.
And I think I've moved through kind of all three stages now, and that stage between 2010 and 2019 was that sort of struggling. So I would, and often relapse can be worse than when I was gambling all the time, because, you know, I wasn't trying to stop then.
Yeah.
And the idea of like building things up again, you know, getting, so I said before that I was wanting to do a sports journalism course when I was 23, so not long after the suicide attempt, I applied to university, I got in, and I did that course, and I ended up getting a first, and you know,
fantastic.
Things were really good. And then I had a relapse, and you know, you build up life, you build up your financial situation, your relationships, your employment prospects, all those kind of things. And just always felt that everything was at risk all the time, because in the back of my mind it was like, when's it going to happen? When am I going to have that moment of weakness and relapse? And often my relapses were online, because by then online gambling had really taken hold, and you know, the industry of kind of lure people to bet. And I think that you know, I just never felt safe, really, even though I had long periods of abstinence. I think the longest was 18 months in that time. In the back of my mind, it was like, when am I going to pull this carpet from under my feet and everything's going to come crashing down again?
Yeah. I mean, as somebody who has experienced depression, and kind of like you as well, has I had a lot of time of being up and down, and eventually decided that I needed to really go do the deep work and get a therapist and work with that person until I was in a really sound position. I didn't have an addiction, but I do understand that feeling of not feeling safe with yourself. I had, certainly some self-destructive kind of tendencies. And so I do understand having a kind of underlying fear that you're going to blow your own life up somehow. Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. And also to doing the work, to getting in and what you were saying about really getting in at the root of what's going on, getting in at the foundations and fixing that rather than just looking at coping mechanisms and how do you avoid triggers and that and so on. It's really inspiring to hear that you've done that work and being able to remove some of the triggers from yourself. That's really wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. I think as well, it's a combination of, for me, the therapy and the meetings and the 12-step philosophy. It's because a lot of the 12-step work I do is individual. It's me sitting down, writing, you know, answers to thought-provoking questions about myself, my past, my addiction. And the word gambling is very rarely mentioned, actually, in the program.
Right.
Gambling's almost the... Well, gambling was my misplaced solution to whatever the problem was. And actually what I think the therapy and the 12 steps and the meetings and everything is about is understanding what the problem was. And then being able to apply sort of manageable solution rather than looking for it in other things. I also think, you know, you mentioned depression there as well. And I recently had a bout of depression, and it really surprised me in a couple of ways. One, that it happened at a time when I was completely free from gambling, that I felt for the first time in my life that I would never need to gamble again, maybe not ever even want to gamble again, because in the past I'd always put that down to as a result of a relapse or as a result of my addiction. But it just happened, you know, it came out of the blue, as it does for so many people. But the second thing that I surprised myself with was how I dealt with it. Because for me in the past, I used to just run away. Gambling was an example of that. Alcohol was an example of that. But when I got depressed, I would just pull the covers over my head and turn off my phone and not want to speak to anybody. And then that act in itself would make it harder to get out of the depression, because I would have lost a job because I'd have gone AWOL officially or whatever. But this time I actually spoke to my employers. I managed to, you know, find the courage to say, you know, at the moment. I'll give some credit to my therapist here, because I spoke to her first and I said to her that I'm... I laugh now when I think about what I said. I said, you know, I've got a lot of the symptoms of depression here, but I'm not depressed. and she just said, okay, how does that work? and actually, then I admitted, you know, and I think in addiction, in any mental health thing, a lot of denial goes on. A lot of, you know, we talk about stigma publicly. I think a lot of the time the stigma exists in our own head. And I was like, if I ring my boss, he might not believe me. And I work for a mental health charity. I think this is unlikely that that's going to be the route they go down. But yeah, I managed to actually find the courage to do things properly.
Yeah.
And it really accelerated my recovery from that. You know, it was a week or 10 days before I was sort of doing a slow return to work and things, when in the past it knocked me out for months.
Yeah. I think that's amazing. It's so brave to change how you respond to something like that. It really does take some courage and guts to, because there's a vulnerability in it, right? In saying, this is what I need. even to, as you say, a mental health charity. And I think that's a vulnerability, particularly that men are discouraged from showing. Do you think that their sort of masculinity and kind of male stereotypes and so on have been a factor in how you, in your mental health, in how you've had to deal with these things in the past?
Definitely. And I think only, sadly, a lot of men in particular will only find that level of vulnerability and courage when they go through something, you know, when they go through something horrific, maybe get to a point, perhaps didn't need to get to mental it if they were able to speak out before and talk about how they feel. I think that, you know, in truth, women are leading the way on this. I think I watched Brené Brown, the Netflix thing that she did, and in that she talked about courage and vulnerability being the same thing, effectively.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've come to that really sort of struck a chord with me. And so I think that the difference is that men often see courage as this sort of macho bravery, when actually true courage is saying, I need help.
Yeah. It's the difference between physical risk and emotional risk, isn't it? There's a courage to put your body on the line, and then there's another courage that's about putting your connections with other people on the line, and they feel very different. I think that's fantastic. We're big Brené Brown fans around here as well, so yeah, it's interesting that you bring her up. So your employer now, I'm assuming you were talking about Sporting Chance. Tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, so Sporting Chance were founded in the year 2000 by Tony Adams, the ex-Arsenal and England football captain, who had a well-documented struggle with alcoholism. And when he got sober, he basically got a lot of calls from a lot of other sports people asking him how he did it.
Right.
And realised that there wasn't much support for people in that industry, for men with addiction and other mental health issues. You know, just leading on from the conversation we've just had, it's a very macho industry where any sort of sign of vulnerability is seen as a sign of weakness. And people sort of very privately going to Tony and asking, you know, how did you get this support? So he got a team of experts together and set up the Sporting Chance Clinic, which was initially a residential facility for sports people struggling with addictive disorders.
Right.
And that still exists, but actually the majority of the work that the charity do today is dealing with other mental health issues such as depression, low mood, anxiety, many, many other issues. And they have a huge counselling network so that any professional sports person can phone up Sporting Chance and get paired with a counsellor close to where they live if they want to, you know, have support with the mental health issues, all confidential, all funded by the governing bodies of, for example, the PFA in football and the equivalent in other sports. And yeah, they were able to just access that support in confidence. And obviously the ones that struggle with addictive disorders are still able to go and have some rehab at the clinic, where they've got facilities to keep them fit physically and mentally as well, which is important for a professional sports person, so they can return to their club or to their sport in the best physical and mental condition.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you would need that specialist facilities.
Yeah,
I've always thought the pressure on sports people, particularly from a very young age, to be, and often very suddenly, to be a role model must be very challenging.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think, there are all sorts of issues that come out these days, and if anyone speaks about an issue publicly, it's almost like they have to be the flag bearer for that issue.
Yes.
And what I suppose Sporting Chance provides is, well, you can get help for the issue, but it's up to you whether you want to go out and talk and take that responsibility. You know, you don't have to. So, you know, we see a lot of sports people. And the other part of our work as well is education, which is going out into sporting organisations, clubs, etc., speaking to the young players about these issues and maybe helping them to understand where they sit a little bit. So I personally do a lot of the education around gambling, but we have stuff and more general stuff on general mental health and well-being, understanding emotions, you know, talking to groups of men about how they feel in certain situations and getting them to challenge their own thoughts and feelings and to understand themselves, kind of hopefully in a way that can prevent somebody going down the same route that I did.
That absolutely makes sense. Yeah. We like to try and end these episodes with some advice and information for our listeners that they can take away and use. And I guess the obvious thing for us to go into here is, as I said at the top, lockdown has resulted in a lot more people gambling than previously might have done. So I was wondering if you have any advice for listeners who are hearing what you have to say and maybe recognizing something in their own or other people's behavior. First of all, I guess, what are the signs of problem gambling?
Yeah, it's difficult because it is, unlike alcohol and other drugs, there are not really any or many physical signs. So things like somebody being tired perhaps all the time, obviously that could be a number of other things, but people that have got a problem with gambling will often gamble longer than planned.
Right.
And if they're doing that on the internet, then that might include staying up quite late into the night doing it.
Yeah.
So irritability, restlessness, all those kind of things. But also if you know, someone's quite, the financial status is fluctuating, someone who used to be, you know, quite solid is now asking to borrow money or not able to come out as much anymore because they don't have any money, or alternatively all of a sudden seem to have a lot of money because they might have had a win. So swings in mood as well, because often the way that a gambler works is that they'll be very high on winning and very low on losing. So those kind of things as well. And recognizing it in yourself is obviously the hardest thing to, first of all, identify, but secondly, to admit, because obviously you don't want to. And again, speaking about men in particular and people in sport, the idea of being beaten, you know, we live in a society where it's like you cannot lose. So chasing money sort of plays into that in for a gambler. But I just think maybe in the moments of reflection, just to ask yourself, you know, a few sort of questions about how long did you intend to gamble? How much money did you intend to spend? Did you lose control in that situation? And I think that's kind of a way of identifying it. And then in terms of trying to stop, there are many things that you can do practically. So online, there are some great tools available now. Gamban is an app that can block access to any form of gambling content on any of your devices. It's a small fee to get that, small subscription fee for a year. Definitely worth it. I think it's about a tenner for a year compared to the thousands of pounds of damage that you might do if you're gambling. GamStop is a national self-exclusion scheme, which you can sign up to, and it will self-exclude you for up to 5 years from all of the UK regulated gambling operators online. And there are similar schemes in places like casinos, bingo halls, betting shops, although probably that one's not as effective because it's not a membership-based thing. But you can self-exclude yourself from any land-based gambling establishment as well. And I also think that the most important thing is to actually get help to understand why you're doing this, to understand the environment. You know, often with addiction, turns out that a lot of the time it's not your fault. You know, a lot of the time it's a mental health condition, or you might have been lured in by tactics from, you know, the industry, particularly people who are gambling online. And so I think just kind of speaking to someone, getting help, whether that be through a support group, a therapist, both. You know, the NHS now have gambling clinics as well. I sit on an advisory panel, a sort of experts by experience panel for the Northern Gambling Service, which has got, I think, three clinics in the north of England. So all the information for that will be on the NHS website as well. And they've got a really good success rate in treating people with gambling problems. So yeah, I think that you do all the things possible to stop. And in the early days, if it means, you know, treating yourself like a bit of a child again and handing over your finances to a partner, then that's fine.
Yeah.
But I've also met people who've tried to do that as a way of kind of as a solution, as a sort of silver bullet solution. And for me, recovering from addiction is about living a normal life or even living your best life. And I think that you need to see sort of progress in those areas. So like I'm managing my own finances and things now, and I'm doing it very well. And I've sort of, I use Monzo for my banking, and they've got a gambling block on their app, so I can block gambling there as well. So there are loads of ways that you can help.
Yeah.
There's not one silver bullet, but my approach has been to do as much as possible so that I can feel safe and then focus my attention on the things that I actually want to do to live a happy and productive life.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. We'll put the information that you've given us there into the show notes and links for anybody who wants to check those things out. But I really love what you're saying here about how it's not just a journey away from, it's also a journey towards, and about building a future that makes you happy, not just getting away from gambling. Because in a way, well, you talked about how gambling was an escape, and now you're saying you're building a life you don't need to escape from. You're building a life you're happy going towards.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't have actually used that phrase many times myself. That's exactly what recovery is to me. It's about living a life and building a life that I don't need to escape from anymore, which is probably why I don't get the urges and I'm not triggered in the same ways that I used to be. So yeah, I think it's very, very important that you know, you don't just stop.
Yeah.
You actually look for a different way to live.
That's wonderful. That's fantastic. Chris, it's been frankly a really inspiring conversation. I'm kind of emotional at this moment. It's just been wonderful talking to you. If people want to learn more about you, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm probably most active on Twitter, so it's at Chris Murphy 180. The number's 180. It's a darts terminology, so people can find out about you know, my recovery journey and pick up some knowledge about darts on the side as well.
Awesome, excellent. Anywhere else?
I think it's the same on Instagram, but yeah, I'm more active on Twitter, so that's the best place to engage. And if you're interested in little old me, then feel free to follow.
Fantastic. Well, I think our listeners will definitely be interested in hearing more from you after today. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to Squanderlust, the podcast about the emotional side of money with me, Martha Lawton. If you've enjoyed the show, please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love one of those nice 5-star reviews too. Or you can tell a friend about us, maybe somewhere on social media where we're at SquanderlustPod. You can also find us at SquanderlustPod.com, where we put show notes, useful links and ways to support the show. Squanderlust is sponsored by Wardour Studios in Fitzrovia, London, with production by David Smith, Alicia Cunningham, Charlie Brandon King and Tom Berry. Our theme music is by Wardour Studios and graphic design by Jason Reed.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.